Yeah, well, it's a pleasure to be here today. I'm looking forward to the opportunity to interact with you all this afternoon. So I'm going to look at adapting disease management to global change, and I'll have some emphasis on network structures, since it's one of the a key interest of mine. So I'll give you a quick overview. So first I'll talk a little bit about challenges from climate change, then an introduction to networks in case you're not familiar with them already, impact network analysis, and then some ideas about sustainability and resilience in this context, and finally some points for discussion, since as I understand this is a workshop. So I'm going to go through these topics fairly quickly and then and leave it to you to bring up which ones you would be interested in discussing some more. And I'm going to mention them at the beginning, some of my questions that I think are interesting. Of course, you all have your own questions, I imagine. But one question I think is interesting is, what are the strengths and weaknesses of disease management systems in current scenarios, right? Even without climate change, we have a lot of shortcomings in management, and some strengths, of course. Some strengths are systems where there's really good disease resistance in popular and effective cultivars. So plant pathologists would tend to think that that's the best success story, right? When you can just have effective disease resistance in the cultivars that everybody likes to grow and likes to consume. But then, of course, there are a lot of scenarios where we don't have that, like Huanglongbing, probably people are discussing a lot here. So that's sort of a baseline question. Is adapting disease management to climate change the same as adapting to climate variability? In some ways they are, right? So well, one obvious difference would be if climate change results in the extreme conditions occurring more frequently, and also new types of extreme conditions that we haven't seen before. What are no regrets options for preparing disease management for climate change? So if we're preparing for climate change, are our adaptation strategies such that even if climate change doesn't occur the way we think it would, are they still going to be good strategies? How effective can individual decision making be, and when are policy changes needed? So one thing about managing disease compared to drought stress, for example, is that what your neighbor does affects you, right? So if your neighbors are doing a really bad job of managing disease, it's going to affect you. If they're doing a bad job of managing their drought problems, it won't affect you quite as directly, though I mean there could be indirect routes of effect, right? But if your neighbors do a bad job of managing infectious disease, then it will tend to affect you, right? So policy might be important for effective management. And probably you have other questions as well. So I'll plant those in your minds as things that might be interesting to discuss for the scenarios and the systems that you're familiar with. I'll also mention job opening for postdoctoral scientists. In case this kind of system analysis is interesting to you or to people that you know or work in your group, I'm looking for some people that would be interested to pursue these sorts of analyses. And I have some flexibility about system as well, so we could negotiate about that. So first, thinking about challenges from climate change. Well, I'm probably preaching to the choir here. You're probably already familiar with plant disease and the problems they cause. This is kind of an interesting overview. It's getting a little old, but it's hard to come up with really good estimates of yield loss. And this is one that people often refer to. So, and for some reason, splits viruses and pathogens. But so pathogens, the potential loss without management, estimated to be pretty substantial, and then management reduces it somewhat. Viruses, not such effective management. Not such a big loss, but management as of 2006 was estimated as not being that effective. Weeds can give really big loss, but then in some senses they're easier to manage. There is a method to manage weeds. For some diseases, there just isn't really much of a method to manage them. So if we think about plant pathogens and climate change, so if you've taken plant pathology courses, you're familiar with the disease triangle plant pathologists talk about all the time, right? So the idea that to get disease, you've got host, pathogen, and environment that are conducive to disease, and that they're interacting with each other. And so if we think about global change, all these things can be changing, all these factors can be changing, which makes it a little bit difficult to predict what the results of climate change will be, as the triangles can shift in different ways, right? So even if climate is becoming more conducive to disease, if there are effective advances in host resistance, then that can counterbalance it. And as we think about scales, plant pathologists are trying to learn more and more about mechanisms. So at the smaller scales, we're trying to understand how different stresses are affecting host-pathogen interactions and the host and pathogen processes at a local scale, say, then understanding these other types of interactions. And then at larger scales, there are effects that can be occurring. For example, if there are bigger storms, then there may be more mixing of pathogens, right? So one advantage we have for now, at least, is that a lot of pathogens are only in one part of the world and haven't spread to other parts of the world. But it's likely that sooner or later they were, but if we can put it off for 100 or 200 years, that's very advantageous. But if there are a lot of storm systems, that may make it harder if there are bigger storm systems. For example, soybean rust being introduced to the U.S. probably in a hurricane. And just some key effects that are pretty clear-cut. Well, you know, it's interesting that for a range of reasons, people debate, is climate change really happening or not? But nobody really debates whether weather affects plant disease risk, because it's so obvious, right? So like the most obvious thing, that fungi and bacteria that infect foliage are really driven by temperature and moisture in different forms. And nobody debates that. And so if those change, then you're going to get different disease risk. Another really big effect that can occur is effects of if overwintering and oversummering risk change for pathogens or their vectors, where that can really change epidemics. If instead of having disease come in later in the season, you have disease right at the beginning of the season and it just gets worse during the season, of course, that's a huge difference. And as I mentioned, climate extremes, you might get temperatures that are, well, not just temperatures, but a set of climate parameters that you've hardly ever seen before and that could be very conducive to pathogens. So that can occur. The reverse can also occur, of course. If you get more drought and there's a range of pathogens that don't do well during the drought, then those would actually be less of a problem under that scenario. In phenology, especially for pathogens that infect flowers, you know, whether the availability of that pathogen when the plant is blooming can be a key factor. And it's an open question, well, for all of these, to what extent pathogens can adapt to new conditions under climate change. Phenology, it's a really interesting question, like for whether, you know, in the distribution of the timing of the pathogen availability, whether there's a tail that's big enough, even if the time of flowering shifts, that those will just reproduce then. Of course, pathogens have the advantage of really rapid reproduction cycles. And just to think about climate and our options for management within a field, so host resistance, like I was saying, is what most plant pathologists would think of as the ideal if we can achieve good host resistance and good varieties. But of course, host resistance can be temperature sensitive. And as we were discussing here too, pathogens are evolving to overcome resistance all the time. You know, the Red Queen metaphor, that you have to run really fast just to keep in place. So that's the case for a lot of crop breeders that have to keep making sure that they have effective resistance in popular varieties. And I think it's an open question to what extent changing climate will actually alter this this Red Queen endeavor, whether you have to run even faster or not. And then cultural practices like timing of planting and use of variety mixtures. So timing of planting, you can imagine, can be trickier too. Similar to the phenology question, if climate's shifting, the knowledge that growers have of what timing is a good strategy may become less useful. People may have to update that regularly. And cultural practices like intercropping and variety mixtures, in our experience, they're less effective when you have really heavy inoculum pressure. And so if the conditions surrounding that field change, then they may become less useful. And so with any pesticides as well, then there's the question of I think Lou probably will have some interesting examples of pesticides for weeds. So for plant pathogens, that's also important if you're managing weedy hosts of pathogens. And biocontrol, well, that's a whole other issue, like all the interactions between microbes too. Biocontrol in plant pathology hasn't been as successful as, for example, host resistance. But we're probably getting a lot of benefits that we haven't even quantified from reduced pathogen risk because of microbes that are present. And so that's another sort of wild card for whether big changes will result in outcomes that we couldn't have predicted because we were benefiting from a sort of biocontrol or disease suppressive soils kind of scenarios that we hadn't fully appreciated in the first place. This is an example of some work that we did where we were looking at potato mixtures for late blight management. And so late blight is a hard disease to manage. If you're not familiar with it, it kicked off the Irish potato famine and it continues to be a big problem around the world. And when we were using mixtures to manage it, if it was low disease pressure, we'd get some modest benefits that contributed to management. But where we had more conducive conditions and more disease, we really didn't keep that benefit. So like I was saying, this is probably another type of scenario where diversity gives us some benefits, but if conditions get worse and more conducive for disease, we might lose some of that benefit that maybe we weren't even aware of in the first place. So a common thing for plant pathologists, like many biologists then, is to start to look at where diseases will become more of a problem or less of a problem under climate change. So for example, in this work of Adam Sparks, we were using disease forecasting models. So late blight is something has been really a focus of interest, and so people have developed lots and lots of disease forecasting models for it. And so part of what Adam was doing here was rescaling that to look at to use this disease forecasting model that was developed for short time scales and to apply it in over a larger extent and longer time scales. So here's an example of these kinds of forecasts. Well, and it's interesting, the title, too. We debated this title a lot. Climate change may have limited effect on global risk of potato late blight. And I think one thing that we regret about this title is that it doesn't fully express the idea that some places it gets worse and some places it gets better. But it kind of averages out globally in this case, in this analysis. Well, I should say, you know, usually these distribution analyses make lots of simplifying assumptions. So I wouldn't go on record as saying, like, oh yeah, if we said it would become less of a problem, quit worrying about it. Because there are a lot of other factors that may end up being the most important that we glossed over in this analysis. But it's kind of interesting to see this idea of winners and losers in climate change. So for late blight, some places would have less late blight risk, and some places would have more. Here are some examples where there'd be higher risk, like Rwanda and Ethiopia, where you have some increased risk of potato late blight. Some places there'd be reduced risk because of lower moisture, right? So even if the temperatures are more conducive to late blight, if there's not enough moisture, then you'd get less late blight. And also, I don't know if you followed the debate about climate change and malaria, but it's pretty interesting, because if you go purely by climate, malaria would become worse a lot of places, but then if you throw in the argument of human management, we're getting better at managing malaria all the time. If you throw in that argument, then actually you can end up having lower malaria risk. So that's an important feature, and it's really kind of a weakness, I think, in many of our systems, our ability to predict how well people will manage something. I mean, we'd like to be able to predict that, right? But that seems even harder than predicting plant pathogens. So, and we've looked at this a little bit. So plant pathogens, though not as tricky as people, are tricky in a lot of ways, right? Their interactions with all the other microbes. So we started looking at this, too, in terms of complexity, the amount of information needed to adequately predict outcomes. So if we're just putting in temperature and precipitation or relative humidity, we're not necessarily capturing everything that's happening in all the microbial interactions. Well, and of course, the global change also includes, in addition to environment, transportation, and market changes, too, for as I mentioned before, one big advantage we have with plant disease is that there are a lot of important plant pathogens that are only present in part of the world and not other parts. But as time passes, we'll probably lose that benefit unless we figure out other good ways to actually eradicate pathogens, which is hard to do. So some things that we need to understand. So growers, for within-season tactical decision-making, they have to learn how to adapt that to climate change scenarios, and then for longer term decisions, how they need to modify their choice of cultivars, for example, if they need to incorporate more disease resistance. For plant breeders, a lot of the question is like, what diseases to prioritize where, right? So ideally, when we're developing these maps of increased and decreased risk, we can contribute to those questions. And similar question for policymakers and donors, what do they need to prioritize and what kind of timeline? It's interesting, too, to think about how financial tools like insurance can buffer farmers against increased variability. But they can have, you can end up with perverse incentives, too, if you're not careful, if you follow the insurance debates. Like in the U.S., there can be some incentive for people to keep growing the same thing, right, so that you can have a basis for insurance calculations. And, of course, if you're looking at natural systems, there are a lot of other interactions to take into account as well. This Haddon et al. Paper has been pretty influential, and they make this argument, which is part of my motivation for talking about impact network analysis, this idea that multidisciplinary problems require multidisciplinary solutions, integrated rather than disciplinary science. And this has been some of the sort of thinking that I've had in developing the impact network analysis that I'll mention in a moment. I think it's also interesting to check this out for IPM adaptation in developing countries and what keeps it from happening. So in this survey by Parsa et al., they looked at what reasons people give for not adapting IPM strategies. It's pretty interesting. It's fairly well distributed, though. It's interesting that a third is outreach weaknesses. So, I mean, that's something that hypothetically, if we had the political will, we could get rid of, right? And let's see, so networks. So in case you're not familiar with thinking about networks more formally, so in a network you could you can describe systems in terms of nodes and the edges that link them. And the edges may have some weights that indicate something about the level of interaction between the nodes. And it can be something that changes over time. Like whenever we're thinking about environmentally driven systems, they're going to be dynamic. And the nodes could be anything. Often they're locations in spatial networks, like fields or plants, depending on which scale you're thinking about. They could be entities, like people, or species in food webs, or genes, molecules. And then the edges could represent anything regarding the interaction between them, like how likely they are to influence each other, or how likely something is to move between them. And again, those could change depending on environmental conditions. So like a type of network I think about a lot then would be a geographic network where here's some node, say it's a field, and the field has microbial communities and some level of plant disease, has some kind of environmental conditions, certain plant communities, maybe just one plant species if it's a monoculture, but then weed species as well. And then the information that people have about it and how that influences their decisions. And so several components of that can move around, then, of course, through the system. And just to give you a taste, if you know something about the network structure, you can start to make some conclusions right away. You might want to follow them up with other investigations, but if you know something about a network, like it has this kind of structure, you can start to say some things about the nodes and how important they are in that structure. Maybe it's easiest to think of it as an epidemic network, right, that a pathogen can move from one of these nodes to another, maybe the node is a field. So degree centrality is one important feature, like how many links does each node have? So some of these have three links, some of them just have one link, and so in an epidemic network, that's one measure of risk. The more links you have, the more likely, all things being equal, you are to pick up a pathogen. Closeness centrality, so a measure of how readily other nodes can be reached. So both of these had pretty high closeness centrality because they're relatively close to all of the other nodes. Betweenness centrality, so how important it is as a bridge between nodes. So this one isn't very important in terms of betweenness centrality, but this one is because whenever you want to get from one of these to the others, you'd run through it. So it would be a key bridge in an epidemic network, for example. Or then the centrality of neighbors, too. Like if you're, like since this one is linked to an important a neighbor that's important in a lot of ways, so it has some higher risk. This one doesn't have very important neighbors, for example. So you can start to look at inherent risk in systems with some of these types of structures. And one thing I'll just mention is the phytobiome. So I just came here from the APS, American Phytopathological Society meeting, and you might know that it has a phytobiome initiative. It's trying to really emphasize studies of the phytobiome as an integrating force. And as you probably know, that's a sort of big black box for now. We don't know much about what's inside that box, but we're just starting to understand what's inside. And I think understanding the network structure is one interesting way. Understanding how microbes are associated and whether those associations are based on biological interactions or just a shared environmental preference, and how they identify plant productivity. So, well, I've heard other people use the analog that we're still in the Stone Age, right, that we don't really understand anything about these microbial communities, but and which is a little scary, too, when you think about how important they probably are, that they probably have lots of roles in plant health that we don't understand yet, and that they might be influenced by climate change in ways that we don't understand, too. So that's another sort of wild card aspect, I think. And just to throw this out, I think it's a fascinating example from plant pathology, Pseudomonas thuringii. So, as you may well know, it has a big role in ice nucleation, but then it's also a plant pathogen, which is kind of an interesting. So if you have a lot of Pseudomonas thuringii building up in plant communities, it could well be influencing atmospheric processes. So it's kind of interesting potential for feedback loops that don't get considered too often. But let's see, so impact network analysis. So this is a big focus for me to understand these structures. So the idea of impact of research products, like information or training, disease resistance, and so on, and the impact on the spatial ecological processes, like crop productivity and so on, and the impact through the communication of decision-making networks and how they link to the physical, biophysical networks. So thinking about, in this case, say, a disease management component and the quality of information about it, how it gets communicated and influences decisions, and then how those influence the epidemic network that's related to it. So the idea that there's some kind of information or technology, there's this network of lots of people, growers, extension agents who are influencing them, and so on, and then the biophysical network, in our case, epidemic, and how these layers influence each other and how we can integrate across the heterogeneity and of the different systems, and then some outcome that's interesting to us, like yields often or ecosystem services. And part of my interest in developing the system is to try to draw on all the ideas and platforms that are being developed in the context of network analysis. So for example, in physics and electrical engineering, there's huge activity to understand how networks how to optimize networks and what kind of vulnerabilities are in networks. And I'm interested in trying to draw on that body of knowledge and concepts to apply to this this setting of impact network analysis for biological systems. There's not been that many applications of this kind of synthesis in agricultural systems. Ribaudo and Dangle have some interesting examples. Marco Pautasso, Mike Jagger, Mike Shaw have done some interesting work too. More work has been done in veterinary systems and human systems, for example, looking at vaccinations and whether, I guess, people understand what's going on in a situation, they choose to vaccinate or not to vaccinate, depending on what kind of networks of communication they're part of. And thinking about information quality, I don't know if you all have followed the psychology journal that decided not to use statistics anymore. Have you followed that story? So, which is kind of shocking, like, oh. Well, so I did a degree in statistics back in the day, so it's really interesting to think you could get a degree in a discipline that another discipline would reject outright. But I mean, I think it's not that all of psychology rejects statistics, but a certain journal did. And there are, you know, papers like this floating around too, and p-values are just the tip of the iceberg in terms of statistical problems. So that's one of my interests in these systems too, is how good is the information that we're bringing to bear in these systems in the first place. And then decision making and how climate variability and color of weather time series or the degree of temporal autocorrelation influence outcomes. So here we just, I would view this as just kind of a start, but an interesting start to look at this and how decision making is based on current or recent weather conditions and how that in these different sorts of environments, how those kinds of decision making play out. And then, of course, plant pathologists, is that 5 minutes? Okay, I think I'm behind. Well, I'll gloss over some of these cases. And like I say, if particular topics are of interest, we can discuss it some more later. So we've looked at things like the connectivity of the American agricultural landscape in terms of crop availability. So of course that's important for ease of spread of pathogens or insect pests. And we're scaling that up to a global perspective too on networks of cropland availability. And once you understand something about that, you can start to look at sampling and mitigation strategies in terms of the network locations that are particularly important. And here's some interesting work. Well, again, Marco Patasso and Mike Digger and their colleagues have done interesting work looking at horticulture specifically and the nursery trade and how these kinds of networks of exchange in the nursery trade are important for risks. And also post-harvest systems tend to get less attention, but here's some work of John Hernandez-Nasa and our colleagues here, where these are really obvious nodes in a network for grain storage, right? And we can look at their structure and the vulnerabilities in them, and then how the movement network can be influenced by management communication and how those both would influence the insect and fungus movement network. Let's see, so I'll just touch on a few points in the context of sustainability and resilience. Maybe I'll blip over these a little bit. For example, in the context of crop breeding networks, so if you're thinking about groups that are breeding for resistance, it's interesting to me to, and it's been done very little. It's something that we're developing more, it's like breeding of, or modeling of crop breeders and how they make decisions about sharing material. And so here's a hypothesis I hope you might find interesting. So if we look at something like the mean node strength among crop breeding groups for genetic sharing, so I mentioned node degree. Node strength is just a measure of the how much, so node strength is how many links you have, and then node degree is how many links, and node strength is sort of the sum of the weights of all those links, so how strong are they, the sum of those links. So if the mean node strength among crop breeders is very strong, then you'd have more sharing. And then if you look here at the percentage cropping area with effective resistance deployed. So if you don't have any effective regulation, you might expect something like this, right? As people are sharing resistance genes more and more, you probably get better deployment through the landscape. But then at some point, you're going to have some people deploying the resistance in ways that makes it break down faster. But if you can have effective regulation, maybe you could continue to get those benefits. So to me, that's an interesting kind of structure to think about in terms of crop breeding networks and how they would influence our capacity for adaptation. I think I'll blip over that for now. So just to summarize in some ways, so thinking about communication networks, so making sure key people are in place and the message is in a form that's readily transferred. So if you think about the utility of and whether people, the utility that people experience in an exchange, if they want to continue getting information from an extension agency, it's partly going to be a function of how readily the message is transferred. Decision networks, so if there can be optimal incentives and regulations. For invasion networks, the actual biophysical networks, can you identify the best locations for sampling and mitigation, efficient sampling and mitigation? And then to see how these interact, so to try to optimize, keeping all those components in mind. So thinking about sustainability and resilience in these sorts of linked systems, so again, we can have think about a structure where, suppose this is weather conduciveness to invasion of a new pathogen, and this is some impact network component value that results in a 5% chance of invasion. So suppose your adaptation strategy is to increase the deployment of resistance. So what I'm saying is that over here, this is how much you have to increase deployment of resistance to counteract the weather conduciveness to invasion. Another scenario would be the probability a land manager adopts a new management strategy given awareness of it. So maybe you have an effective strategy for management, but people don't use it for whatever reason. They're not aware of it. They're not convinced it's useful. So it's interesting to try to understand what the shape of this is, right? So if weather is becoming more conducive, how much do you have to do to counterbalance the, in the context of these impact networks? And then it's also important, like thinking about resilience, like if there's a stressor, how are people going to, how quickly can people respond? Let's see, and so then I'll return to the points for discussion. And I'll just mention again this postdoc opening, if you or someone you know is interested in these kinds of system analyses, and put in a plug for our new institute at University of Florida. So I'm developing this concept of impact network analysis, and we're setting up this new Institute for Sustainable Food Systems. And we're interested in other examples that you might have too to look at in this context. And thanks to my colleagues and funders, and I'll just put these points up again. And if you have points you'd like to discuss, or scenarios related to this, or I could throw out more opinions about those, whatever you wish. Thanks.